Good evening. The president is impeached. Now to the Senate and the new North American trade deal. More of the same. Welcome to the WBAI News. This is some of the news for Thursday, December 19th, 2019. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A lengthy investigation by the state and city of New York ended in a resolution with Starbucks. The ubiquitous coffee chain admitted they had violated New York's paid safe and sick leave law. Starbucks had required employees to find a substitute when they used sick leave and, failing that, to face corrective action up to and including termination of employment. The state says Starbucks corrected its policy and is now compliant with the paid safe and sick leave law. The settlement requires Starbucks to pay restitution to current and former employees who were impacted by its illegal sick leave policy. And the stores now must post a notice that workers aren't ever required to find a replacement when they take a day off. And the evolving fight for the soul of the Democratic Party moves to California tonight as a shrinking field of presidential contenders takes the debate stage for a sixth and final time in 2019. The debate was overshadowed by Congress's historic impeachment vote. Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg enter the night at the very center of the high-stakes clash with five other candidates who will share the stage when the event begins at 8 p.m. Buttigieg, the 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana, has emerged as a strong, if surprising, face of the party's more centrist wing. Warren, a 70-year-old Massachusetts senator, has fought for transformative policy to limit corporate influence on the nation's political and economic systems. The debate is set in Los Angeles County, home to the nation's largest Latino population. Three of the candidates who will be on stage are preparing to serve as jurors in the Senate trial of President Donald Trump, who on Wednesday became just the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, where a trial of the president would take place, spoke angrily this morning.
They voted to impeach President Trump. Over the last 12 weeks, House Democrats have conducted the most rushed, least thorough, and most unfair impeachment inquiry in modern history. Now, their slapdash process has concluded in the first purely partisan presidential impeachment since the wake of the Civil War. The opposition to impeachment was bipartisan. Only one part of one faction wanted this outcome. The House's conduct risks a deeply damaging the institutions of American government. This particular House of Representatives has let its partisan rage at this particular president create a toxic new precedent that will echo well into the future. That's what I want to discuss right now. The historic degree to which House Democrats have failed to do their duty and what it will mean for the Senate to do ours. So let's start at the beginning. Let's start with the fact that Washington Democrats made up their minds to impeach President Trump since before he was even inaugurated. Here's a reporter in April of 2016. Donald Trump isn't even the Republican nominee yet. But impeachment is already on the lips of pundits, newspaper editorials, constitutional scholars, and even a few members of Congress. April 2016. On Inauguration Day, 2017, the headline in the Washington Post, "The Campaign to Impeach President Trump Has Begun." That was day one. In April 2017, 3 months into the presidency, a senior House Democrat said, "I'm going to fight every day until he's impeached."
And New York Senator Chuck Schumer afterwards responded that it was the GOP that had no principles.
I ask unanimous consent the quorum be dispensed with.
Without objection.
Now, Mr. President, last night, the House of Representatives voted to impeach President Donald Trump. It is only the third time in our nation's history that the President of the United States has been impeached. The articles of impeachment charge that President Trump abused the powers of his office by soliciting the interference of a foreign power in our elections, not for the good of the country, but to benefit himself personally. The articles also charge that the President obstructed Congress in the investigation of those matters. Together, these articles suggest the President committed a grave injury to our grand democracy. The conduct they describe is very much what the founders feared when they forged the impeachment powers of the Congress. The founders, in their wisdom, gave the House the power to accuse, the Senate the power to judge. We are now asked to fulfill our constitutional role as a court of impeachment. Now that the House of Representatives has impeached President Trump, the nation turns its eyes to the Senate.
Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is holding on to the bill of impeachment, delaying sending them to the, those are the two articles, to the Senate where a trial would be held. McConnell has said the trial will be short. And she said she can only hope the Senate will be fair.
When we bring the bill, which is, just so you know, there's a bill made in order by the Rules Committee that we can call up at any time in order to send it over to the Senate and to have the provisions in there to pay for the impeachment. And then the next step, whatever you want to call it, the trial. That is where you put the managers. I was not prepared to put the managers and that bill yet because we don't know the arena that we are in. Frankly, I don't care what the Republicans say. Any other questions? Not on this subject. I've said this is it. I honored Nancy.
Last night you suggested you need to see a fair process in the Senate.
Well, we'd like to see a fair process, but we'll see what they have, and we'll be ready for whatever it is.
Is that a requirement, or do you need to see a fair process before?
We would hope there would be a fair process, just as we hope that they would honor the Constitution. By the way, I saw some of it, I didn't see it, but I heard some of what Mitch McConnell said today, and it reminded me that our founders, and when they wrote the Constitution, they suspected that there could be a rogue president.
And speaking at a rally in Battle Creek, Michigan, President Trump addressed a crowd of supporters as he was being impeached. He was defiant, angry, and insulting, but he said he didn't feel like anything was happening.
By the way, it doesn't really feel like we're being impeached. The country is doing better than ever before. We did nothing wrong. We did nothing wrong. And we have tremendous support in the Republican Party like we've never had before. Nobody's ever had this kind of support.
Then Trump went on to personally insult deceased Michigan Congressman John Dingell, whose wife, Debbie Dingell, is the new congressperson from his district in Michigan. Trump implied her husband was in hell.
Debbie Dingell, that's a real beauty. So she calls me up like 8 months ago. Her husband was there a long time. But I didn't give him the B treatment. I didn't give him the C or the D. I could have. Nobody would have, you know. I gave the A-plus treatment. Take down the flags. Why are you taking them down? For ex-Congressman Dingell. Oh, okay. Do this, do that, rotunda, everything. I gave him the, everything. That's okay. I don't want anything for it. I don't need anything for anything. She calls me up. It's the nicest thing that's ever happened. Thank you so much. John would be so thrilled. He's looking down. He'd be so thrilled. Thank you so much, sir. I said, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Maybe he's looking up. I don't know. Maybe.
Dingell responded on TV talk shows this morning. This excerpt was taken from MSNBC.
I sort of had a hard time even understanding what was being said. Unfortunately, the first person who got to me told me, asked me what I thought about the president saying my husband was in hell. So a little more context came later, and it hurt. I love my husband, as you well know. We had a love affair, most never have, and it's been a hard holiday season, and those kind of shots, people forget that members of Congress are human, just like them, and we go through some real hard times. The reality is he was a World War II veteran, and was buried at Arlington, which is the only thing he ever asked me for, because he served in World War II defending this country. He was the longest serving member. He was not, contrary to what the president said there last evening in the rotunda. The speaker had asked me if I wanted him to be here at the Capitol, and I did not, because I did not want him to get anything special that other former members did not get. What I wanted him was at our church where we had been married, that I had taught Sunday school when in college, and when we happened to be in Washington on a Sunday, went to Mass. So he did lower the flags, and by the way, he called me. And I appreciated that call. He was very empathetic on that call. His kindness meant a lot, and I was grateful. And still to this day, even after the remarks last night, kindness meant a lot at a difficult time.
He seemed to play to the crowds at these rallies, and he said a similar thing about John McCain, whose family was deeply hurt by that. What is it about the way he behaves in front of these crowds?
You know, I don't know. It makes me sad. I do know, having watched more of these clips than I wanted to, what was said last night, he got a very mixed reaction. And I just think sometimes people need to remember that we're all human. And, you know, I don't like the tone of the rhetoric in this country right now. I've said it many times, you know, it's been one of the things that I've worked on for years. And social media, instead of bringing a tool that brought us together more, people think bullying and vitriolic comments and this whole tone of just cheap shots and divisiveness is okay. And I think we need to get back to a time of civility, and that you can disagree, but you can do it agreeably.
Michigan Congressperson Debbie Dingell earlier today. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And in more national news, on Tuesday, the United States Senate passed its $740 billion National Defense Authorization Act. William Hartung is the director of Arms and Secrecy of the Center for International Policy. He says the Democrats and Republicans were not so divided on defense.
Trump, when he ran for election, said he was tired of these disastrous wars. And I think he kind of gave the impression that he was going to be more restrained or sort of an isolationist. But in fact, he's given the military everything it wants and more. And unfortunately, Congress has mostly gone along with it.
So there's no daylight between the Democrats and the Republicans on this bill?
There were a lot of policy differences. Democrats wanted to stop U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. They wanted to put roadblocks against military action against Iran. They wanted to stop building low-yield, more usable nuclear weapons. They wanted to roll back Trump's attempt to deregulate firearms exports. So in policy, there were some differences. But in terms of the money, Trump came in at $750. The Democratic leadership of the House came in at $733 billion, and they compromised at $738 to $740 billion. So they were just fighting over a few percentage points in terms of how much money the Pentagon actually received.
Where does most of that money go? What are we paying for with $740 billion?
A lot of the money goes to the global military presence, not just the fighting of the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and elsewhere, but also 800 military bases, hundreds of thousands of troops overseas, aircraft carriers that can deploy anywhere in the world, a large nuclear arsenal that's excessive, even if you believe in the idea of deterrence, that if you have some nukes, countries won't attack you. And then just a vast bureaucracy. The Pentagon employs 600,000 private contractors, almost as many people as it has civilian employees. And to some degree, they don't even know what half of these folks are doing. So it's just kind of this machine that sucks up money and doesn't really often have a defense strategy to go with it. It's got more of a strategy of trying to dominate militarily that's gotten the U.S. into all kinds of trouble during this century.
What purpose does it serve to spend, to waste tens and hundreds of billions of dollars on such a bloated bureaucracy?
Part of it is self-interest. The contractors who do the work benefit, both the big ones like Lockheed Martin and the smaller ones who do other things for the Pentagon. They push jobs into the districts of key members of Congress, who then feel like they can't vote against the Pentagon budget because they'll be viewed as anti-jobs in their state or district. To some degree, it's the money-making machine for key individuals, sort of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about. It's part of this notion that the U.S. should be a global interventionist power, that it will help the United States shape the world in its interests. Of course, it's not the interest of the average person necessarily, but the interests of U.S. Companies and sort of U.S. power writ large. And that has failed even in its own terms, if you look what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So we just got the Afghanistan report that was released by the Washington Post, all these cables and emails that seem to show that they knew it wasn't working and that they kept plowing money into it, similar to Vietnam. Just even though this is unwinnable, they knew it was unwinnable, they kept plowing money into it.
That was really the only revelation to anybody who's been following this, was that they knew and that they were basically lying about it, and to sort of document that in black and white, because it was pretty clear that you had a corrupt regime in Afghanistan, the Taliban was making progress, the drug trade was flourishing. There was no prospect of actually kind of transforming that situation. And the Taliban is not a global terrorist organization. The idea of fighting the war once bin Laden wasn't there anymore didn't really make a lot of sense, other than this notion that the U.S. has to exercise its power militarily and that can somehow shape the world in its interests, which is one of the biggest fallacies, I think, of U.S. foreign policy of the last.
Does it really have a deterrent? I mean, is Russia and China cowed by U.S. power, or are other countries giving up their struggles if they're not in line with what the U.S. wants because of the frightening prospect of military intervention by the United States?
Russia or China would not attack the United States, but in terms of their activities in their regions, Russia's intervention in Ukraine, China's projection into the South China Sea, U.S. military power isn't going to change those regional realities. And then, of course, there's countries like North Korea and to some degree Iran who view U.S. threats as a reason to perhaps pursue nuclear weapons or produce them, as North Korea does, as a protection against regime change. Puffing up of military power is creating reactions that actually make the world less safe and to some degree even undermine U.S. power.
Space Force, what do you think of that?
Well, I think the Space Force is a dangerous idea. I mean, basically what you're saying is space is a military frontier and we need a separate armed force to deal with it. And the likely bad ideas that will flow from that will be things like missile interceptors in space, laser weapons. Basically, it makes it more likely there's going to be an arms race in space. And space is not only used by the military to direct operations on Earth, but it's used to run much of our civilian economy. The idea that you would want to make that a theater of war instead of a place for cooperation, I think is incredibly dangerous. And of course, there's been ideas like this for many years, but this kind of codifies it. I think that's a terrible idea.
William Hartung is Director of Arms and Secrecy of the Center for International Policy. His article on the defense budget is out on TruthDig, the website TruthDig. And a revamped North American trade deal nears passage in Congress. It gives both Democrats and Republicans a chance to crow victory. The agreement regulates trade between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Canada is the United States' largest trading partner. Economist Jack Rasmus, he's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College and author of The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. And he says that it's not really that much of a change, despite all the debate.
Trump, he's a free trader, but he's a bilateral free trader. And that's the only difference between them. That's why you see very little difference between what was negotiated by Trump last year, by the way, November 18th, the agreement was negotiated, What's just transpired with the Democrats approving it. The Democrats just attempted to tweak a few things to the original agreement. The original agreement itself does not change very much. No jobs are coming back as a result of it. This talk about content, raising it from North American content from 62.5% to 75%, is really about Mexico not outsourcing any of their auto production to China or somewhere else. You know, it's a 75% North American content, not a U.S. content. The dispute settlement, no change to that. Mexico and Canada both like the way it was. What you see is change as a result of the last-minute Democratic negotiations here, add-ons, has to do with token visuals about improving labor conditions in Mexico. And I say token because there's not really much there either. There's an agreement to increase the wage in Mexican factories that have to do with imports to the U.S. To $16 an hour, but, you know, in 5 years or more, you know, the market forces would have raised it that much, and only on 40% of Mexican imports to the U.S., manufactured imports. So, you know, that's a look-good kind of thing, raise it to $16 an hour, but they would have had to do that in 5 years anyway. And then the other major issue was the enforcement of labor law improvements in Mexico, which the Democrats have made a big deal about. But what that boils down to is the U.S. instead, we want inspectors, labor inspectors, they call them labor attachés, to go into Mexican factories and make sure that the conditions and you know, the wages are actually implemented and they can unionize more. But Mexico balked at that last week, and they said, wait a minute, we didn't agree to labor inspectors or attachés. Well, it appears that that provision, according to, you know, the U.S., was in an annex or a side letter, you see, to the basic agreement. In the basic agreement that Mexico agreed to was these labor panels made up by officials of Mexico and the U.S. who would look into disputes and violations. Well, you know, labor panels is not what it's about. If you don't inspect and find the problem, then there's no labor panel to adjudicate it, you see. So this labor inspector thing is really an obfuscation. You know, Machinist Union, I think it was, came out and declared, look, there's nothing in this deal for protecting labor, really. But that's the compromise. Mexico then compromised, came to the U.S. here a few days ago, and they were told, okay, you know, we don't mean labor inspectors unannounced going into your factories. What we mean is labor attachés, after the panels decide, may, with the panel permission, go and verify in your factories. Well,
and that's Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics, St. Mary's College, and the author of The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. And that's some of the news for Thursday, December 19th, 2019. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.